Rise.
Be seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in the final matter for the morning. That's 090558 Marsh USA Inc. and Marsh McLennan Companies Inc. versus Rex Cook.
May it please the court, Ms. Whitley will present arguments for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. This court should overturn the ruling of the Court of Appeals in this case because Rex Cook signed a non-compete that was part of an otherwise enforceable agreement. That non-compete that Mr. Cook signed was part of his participation in an incentive plan that Marsh set up in 1992. And that plan and that non-compete comply with both the letter and the spirit of the Covenants Not to Compete Act. The act was actually passed just a few years prior to the time that Marsh implemented its plan, and it was passed to overturn this court's decision in Hill versus Auto Trim, Mobile Auto Trim, and to reopen the door to allowing employers to protect their goodwill in the form of customer relationships through a non-compete.
It sounds very compelling so far, but in this particular case, and I guess some of the things the courts are having trouble with is that here you have a stock option agreement, but you're not really giving any additional confidential information that the person would otherwise have.
This is not a confidential information case. And prior to the time of Light, courts had no trouble, except for Hill, finding that a non-compete could be used to protect customer relationships to the extent that they comprise the employer's goodwill. And there were cases prior to Hill that held that. And then all of a sudden in Hill, the court said, well, you know, the employee is nice and goes out and meets the customers. Maybe that's his goodwill. And in direct response to that, the legislature said, no. You're allowed to have a non-compete as long as that non-compete is ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement, and then it's reasonable and all the other issues that we know are present. In Hill versus Auto Trim and Mobile Auto Trim, it's very important to understand what happened. This court said in that case that Mobile Auto Trim couldn't enforce a non-compete to prevent Hill from capitalizing on Mobile Auto Trim's goodwill for Hill's own benefit. And so since then, it's been well documented that the legislature had Hill in mind whenever it passed the act, and that the legislature wanted to go back to the common law as it existed prior to Hill. And the common law as it existed prior to Hill allowed employers to enforce non-compete agreements to prevent their employees from walking out the door with their goodwill.
What if rather than offering stock options, they just said, well, in exchange for you continuing to work here and dealing with our clients and customers and adding to the goodwill, you have to sign this non-compete agreement.
That would be a different case, because in that case there wouldn't be an otherwise enforceable agreement. In this case, it wasn't the stock option. The stock option was part of the plan. He was awarded the stock options not for doing anything, but not for expressly giving a promise. At the time he got the stock option, he was awarded the stock option because under the plan, certain key employees were allowed to receive stock options under the way it was set up. The otherwise enforceable agreement was the signing of the non-solicitation containing specific promises, handing that over to Marsh, and Marsh giving the stock in exchange for that.
But what do you need to make an employee agree not to compete just because you give them stock options? I mean, if anything...
Because that's part of the plan.
But the options would seem to already give an employee incentive to sort of look out for the best interest of and protect their employer. It's not like confidential information where if you disclose it, it can harm your employer. Here, options, you would think the person getting options would want to do all they can to kind of boost the value of the company.
I agree that it's not the same as confidential information, but... We're The options were given as part of a comprehensive incentive plan. That incentive plan had a purpose other than restraining Rex Cook from competing. The purpose of the incentive plan was to link his interest, Rex Cook's interest, with the long-term interest of the shareholders of Marsh, and to incentivize him to grow goodwill. The solicitation, the non-solicitation agreement that he signed was signed in order as a condition of exercise. At the point that he signed it, he got the stock. At that point, ideally, under the plan, he would become an owner and he would continue to act in the long-term interest of the shareholders and to try to get build goodwill. Because after he owned the stock, the more that the stock price went up, the more valuable it would be to him.
What happens when the stock price goes down, as so often happens?
If the stock price went down before he exercised, he wouldn't have. If the stock price goes down after he exercises, then he's an owner, and that would even incentivize him more to try to build the goodwill.
It would incentivize me to go do something else.
And it might. And the plan the plan contemplated from the beginning that it wasn't going to be able to force the employee to continue after the exercise to continue to try to grow the goodwill. Although obviously the ideal situation would be if the employee becomes an owner, he would continue to try to grow goodwill after he had exercised the stock option. But if the employee decided under the plan, which he is allowed to do, to exercise, sign the non-solicitation agreement and exercise, get the stock, sell the stock that day, take the cash and do whatever, and then quit and go to work for a competitor, then the Marsh could not force him to continue to work for the best interest of the shareholders, but the non-compete would kick in then and would prevent him from working against the shareholders.
Back to that scenario, what if the stock is worthless, if it has no value, then what is he receiving?
Then he would not exercise. There would be no reason.
I understand that, but what does that go to? How does that affect his obligation?
Because he didn't have an obligation unless he exercised. The exercise and the transfer of the stock were simultaneous. The option happened a long time ago. The incentive plan comes into being in 1992.
So he gets the option. So if the option is never exercised, then there's no obligation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was up to Mr. Cook to decide whether or not it was worth it to sign the non-compete and to take the stock. And if he didn't want to, he could have left and he could have gone to Lockton unrestrained.
Was Cook somehow more valuable to Marsh McLennan after he received this stock than he was before?
That was a point that was raised by the Court of Appeals in its decision. No, Your Honor, he was always a from the time that he got the option, he was a valuable employee.
So this seems like it's just a naked restraint of trade. It's not like there's confidential information given that sort of increases the consideration for his remaining at the employment. So I don't. So how is this not just a restraint of trade that the Commerce Code prohibits?
The idea of a naked restraint is discussed at length in the restatement. And the restatement says that when two people who have no other relationship agree that one of them is going to pay the other one money for the agreement not to compete, that's a naked restraint. When you're in the employment context, the restraint is not naked because there is already an underlying relationship that gives the parties the reason to want to have a non-compete. In this case, Marsh sought to link Cook's interest with Marsh's shareholders' interest long term and to grow goodwill. The non-compete was not naked because it stopped Cook from the day he exercised walking out the door with the goodwill, the very goodwill that he was just paid or incentivized to create.
Would a covenant like this also be satisfied with increases in pay? I mean, just we're going to incentivize you to stay by paying you more money per month, and that would that be the sort of agreement that makes a covenant not to compete enforceable?
It would be a little bit different because this is a comprehensive plan that has a specific purpose other than to restrain competition. And what you're talking about raises, we've got to look at, is there an otherwise enforceable agreement? Is that the giving of a raise an otherwise enforceable agreement? If it is, and even if it is money, then it would still be, or then it would fit the statute. And then the question would be whether or not it would be reasonable under the circumstances, which is not at issue in this case.
I don't know whether the record shows this or not, but what happened to the stock? I mean, did he sell it? Did he cash out?
He cashed out the same day.
Same.
And the plan contemplated that. That's why, I mean, the ideal situation was to make him an owner, make him act, and
right.
continue acting like an owner. But the plan knew if he didn't do that, that it had to do something to protect what had been incentivized prior. And so.
So he cashed out the same day he exercised the option?
He did, and he took the $50,000 difference and did whatever he wanted to.
Would that create a claim back against him for failure of consideration of the deal? In other words...
Because he's not fulfilling his promises?
When he left, violating the policy, does that create a claim back against him for the value of that stock?
I guess that is a possibility, and I hadn't really thought about that because Mr. Cook made promises to Marsh that would fulfill the purpose that Marsh had when it presented or implemented the plan in 1992, and Marsh wants those promises fulfilled. It doesn't want the stock back. It wanted to give the stock to Mr. Cook as a reward for building that goodwill, but it didn't want him to take that goodwill. The idea is that Mr. Cook could be incentivized by Marsh
right.
through the stock to build his portfolio and could walk out the door with his portfolio.
Just thinking, if it's not enforceable, he did act upon the agreement, and yet he failed to comply with the agreement. So
he certainly did.
Fails. Does that give rise to yet another claim back, having nothing to do with the enforceability of the agreement?
I guess it would, Your Honor. But the fact that there might be another remedy doesn't mean that the legislature didn't mean for Marsh to have this remedy when it overturned Hill by passing the.
Did anything else about Mr. Cook's employment change, hours, conditions, wages, anything else when he received the options?
The options?
When he received the options, did anything else about his employment status or
No, Your
anything
Honor.
Change?
He was a key employee before, and the options, the idea is he's paid every day to come in and maintain customer relationships, to call those customers constantly to make sure that their needs are being met. But if he has an incentive, then he'll go out and find a new relationship that Marsh didn't already have and a new customer and bring that new customer into the fold. And the law has always been in Texas that that customer relationship, even if he found it on his own, that customer relationship belongs to the person who's paying him to develop it. I mean, and I said the law has always been that, except for in Hill, that was different, or the court said it was different, and then the legislature reacted to that. And it's vital in this case to understand two things. One is that customer relationships are Marsh's goodwill. Marsh is an insurance broker. It places insurance with a variety of independent insurance companies for its clients. Rex Cook works for Lockton. Lockton is a direct competitor of Marsh. Lockton places insurance for its clients with a variety of independent insurance companies. The insurance companies that they work, that they sell, they get that insurance placed for, they're all the same. The policies are all the same. The difference, what makes a customer loyal to Marsh is not price. It's not the product that they're selling, because those things are very similar with every other broker. The difference is the customer's relationship with the key primary point of contact at Marsh. And that, for all the customers that Mr. Crook took with him, he was the primary point of contact. We've got to have some way to protect that, and the legislature passed the act with that in mind. Because Hill was right there, and we know, plus it's been documented by everyone, this court, lower courts, and the legislative history, that they said, no, we're going to allow what has always been the common law in Texas, that if your relationship is the key to your goodwill, we're going to allow you to protect that.
Now, let me ask you about the goodwill. Going back to the stock option thing, was that a continuing option? Were additional stocks added to that as time went by, or was it a one-time deal?
It could have been continuing, but it wasn't the option that was the consideration for the otherwise enforceable agreement. It was the stock. But the option was a war.
So in 1996, he could have exercised the stock option, right?
He could have, but he wouldn't, because the day he got it, it wouldn't have been worth more than the option price. But he could have, yes, Your Honor.
At some point, he could have done that, cashed out. What was the, where was the goodwill at that point? What was his incentive to continue in terms of the stock ownership, because he'd already cashed it out?
If he cashed out on the day that he received the option, then he wouldn't have sold it for the difference because there wouldn't have been a difference. So he would have become an owner, and then he would have acted like an owner, and that's what Marsh wanted. Marsh wanted Tim to act like an owner.
While he was there, he had the goodwill at heart for the law, for the company. But after he cashed out, that went away because he was no longer an owner.
I'm trying to understand what your question is exactly.
Well, I'm saying is you want to enforce this agreement because there's some goodwill that's involved in this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because he's an owner. But when he cashes out, he's no longer an owner.
That's right. And so he wants to take the goodwill and use it for somebody else and treat it like it's his own or bring it over to Lockton with him. It belongs to Marsh. Marsh is entitled to keep him from walking out the door with it. And that's the purpose of this. That's the purpose of the non-compete. The purpose of the agreement is not to restrain Cook from competing, but to grow Marsh's goodwill through linking the interest of the employee with the employer long term and through incentivizing him to not just maintain the status quo, but to get the stock up. And I see my time's out.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Whitley.
Thank you.
Court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Latin will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. This case presents the threshold question of what type of consideration justifies a company extracting a covenant not to compete from the promisor. This is not an employment agreement. This is a stock option agreement that the actual consideration for the covenant not to compete was not the award of the options. The actual consideration for the covenant not to compete was the sale to Mr. Cook of publicly traded Marsh stock, not restricted stock, publicly traded stock that anyone in this courtroom can go buy on the open market and not be subject to a covenant not to compete.
But at a different price.
Correct. And the effect of the transfer to Mr. Cook was the difference between, if he chose to exercise it, between the, if any, between the publicly traded stock price and the strike price, the option price at which Mr. Cook received the stock.
Should he have to give the money back?
Actually, that question hasn't been raised here, but I think the answer is no. The answer is no because this court has not allowed a forfeiture provision. Texas law has not allowed a forfeiture provision to be a sort of a backdoor punishment for violation of an unenforceable non-compete. Keeping in mind that Mr. Cook had other obligations under the stock exercise agreement, including the obligation not to disclose confidential information, there's been no allegation in this case that Mr. Cook has violated that duty, has misappropriated confidential information, or has done anything improper with respect to confidential information.
The briefing says that for Mr. Cook to participate in the stock option plan, that arrangement was expressly conditioned on him signing a non-solicitation agreement. Do you agree with the expressly conditioned language?
I agree that it was expressly conditioned on execution of the document called the non-solicitation agreement for exercise of stock options, which includes a non-disclosure provision as well as the covenant not to compete. But this court has been
clear. He read it, of course. He read it, I guess, and could see what it said. Why didn't he say, no, I'm not going to sign this, and I'm not entitled to the stock option?
I think he is presumed to have read it. There's not, I wouldn't have any reason to disagree with that. The question is not whether a person should be bound to a covenant not to compete just because they read it.
He shouldn't have taken the, he could have said, well, if this is what you want, I'm not entitled to the stock.
Perhaps he could have done that. But what that does is it permits the party that is extracting the covenant not to compete to dangle a financial incentive in front of an employee, which is what this was.
And surely an employer can do that. Surely an employer can say, I want to give financial incentives, but I don't, not only to people who are going to be here and who I think are going to be loyal, so I want you to agree to this, and then I'll give you this enhanced incentive.
This court has been quite clear that offering money, as the most simple example, in exchange for a covenant not to compete, does not give rise to an interest in restraining competition.
To be clear about that, because I was a little unsure about your brief, but if an employer wants to give stock options, or but he doesn't want to do it unless he can get a non-competition agreement of some sort, he can't do that. He just can't give the stock option.
I would say that you cannot extract a covenant not to compete in return for a stock option agreement. Well, and may I mention, employee incentives such as stock option agreements are done to maximize the work that their employees do.
Let me just be sure I understand. The employer comes to the lawyer and says, I want to give stock options, but only if I can get a non-compete. Otherwise, I'm not going to give the options. The answer is, don't give the options.
That would not be a good reason to award stock options.
Well, but isn't there a bigger sort of philosophical premise here, and that is that there, you know, this is a state where there's got to be some kind of, or at least Texas has recognized some interest in mobility of workers, and that the restraint of trade based on, I don't know, increases in pay, cost of living assessments, et cetera, are not enough to make a covenant enforceable that restrains an employee's ability to make a living.
Absolutely, that's correct. That was the law in Light, but it was also the law before Light. The Texas law has always assessed the nature of the transaction, the nature of the consideration that justifies the extraction of a covenant not to compete in return. Before the legislature passed the statute that we're here on today, Texas law was broader. It followed the restatement test that allowed the extraction of a covenant not to compete either in support of a valid transaction or relationship, such as an employment relationship. The legislature narrowed that test when it passed the statute that became effective in 1989. And in 1993, the original proposal for the amendment was to expand it back out to provide that a non-compete would be enforceable if it was ancillary to a valid transaction or relationship. That bill did not pass. The bill that was passed maintained the language of otherwise enforceable agreement.
So it seems to me that Mr. Cook extracted $50,000 and just thumbed its nose at Marsh. I mean, how can that be right?
I would look at it differently, Your Honor. I would say that the summary judgment evidence in the form of Ms. Dillenbach's affidavit said that Mr. Cook was awarded options because of his many years of excellent service to the company. That's why employers give it incentives to their employees.
This is as he was walking out the door?
No, sir. The stock option award was made in 1996. Slight clarification, the options vested over a four-year period, 25% per year, and were fully exercisable 4 years later. He did not exercise them until 2005. That was his option. It's an interesting question about why, if this interest was so compelling, it was optional. Why it was that Cook's decision that after 9/11 and before the Elliott Spitzer investigation and whatever else was happening with Marsh stock, why was it that his decision in 2005 to go ahead and exercise those stock options, what was it about that generated an interest in restraining competition? There's a fundamental flaw in the position that the petitioners take, and that is they focus on why they gave Mr. Cook the options. Why has never been the issue? What has always been the issue? Why were the issue, money would justify a covenant not to compete. You can say, I'm giving this employee a double salary and hope that he'll stay here for the rest of his career, or deferred compensation. Why? So that I can protect my customer relationships. That's always what companies want to do with a covenant not to compete.
If hypothetically an employee left and the employee had no non-solicitation or non-compete agreement, no restraining contract at all, and the employee took the company's trade secrets and used them, that employee could be sued under the common law for breach of fiduciary duty money paid, with no ancillary agreement, with no otherwise enforceable contract.
That's absolutely correct. That the law views confidential information of the as the kind of thing that deserves particular protection. It's very difficult to determine when confidential information has been used in violation of a previous employer's rights, which is the reason it's the hallmark of the kind of thing that justifies a covenant not to compete. If a customer decides to move when an employee with no non-compete moves to a new company, well, why did that client move? Did they move just because they liked the new company? Did they move because of a trade secret? The covenant not to compete allows a cooling off period, some certainty for the prior employer to reestablish that relationship for some period of time to pass before
competition
begins.
So given the common law claim for breach of fiduciary duty in the hypothetical case,
that I mentioned, why, if I'm the employer, would I even use the non-compete statute? It raises hurdles. It requires more than a breach of fiduciary duty claim requires to be proven in some respects. And in a breach of fiduciary duty claim, if I'm the employer, I could get damages. I could probably get an injunction to stop the violation. I might be able to get an order to get my confidential information and trade secrets back. Why would I even use this statute if it erects the hurdles you're talking about?
I would say that a covenant not to compete makes it easier for an employer to protect their information, because if the customer moves their business to the new company or with the new employer, there are simple questions. Did the employee under this agreement solicit or service that business? Was the customer covered by the non-compete, and did they solicit? Not did they use confidential information that was necessarily in their head in soliciting that customer. So you do have a much brighter line with a covenant not to compete, which makes it a powerful tool for employers to use to protect their information.
Let's assume that the covenant not to compete here was enforceable. Do you have any complaint about the reasonableness of the restrictions imposed by the agreement?
There are at least several problems with the reasonableness prong.
They challenged below?
For purposes of our motion at the time, the motion assumed for purposes of the motion that all of the other elements of the pleading were true, and it attacked only the threshold question of whether the nature of the consideration gives rise. There are at least two or three problems with the scope that are not before the court.
As you know, that with Sheshinoff and Mann Frankfurt, we're trying to get away from the technical disputes.
Yes.
And reasonableness is not a problem here. But the question is whether this is a technical dispute is enforceable or not.
I appreciate that question very much. There are two parts to that answer. First of all, the types of technical disputes that the court resolved in Sheshinoff and Mann were issues of contract formation. There was this problem of forming an otherwise enforceable agreement under the auspices of at the time the agreement was made. Sheshinoff resolved the issue of when performance had to occur such that the otherwise enforceable agreement was created. Did it have to be created instantaneously, or could it happen later? Upon actual performance. And Mann also applied black letter contract law to say an implied contract is an otherwise enforceable agreement. So both of those cases apply black letter contract law to the otherwise enforceable agreement component. But assessing the nature of the consideration is not at all a technical dispute. This court has always asked two questions: whether a covenant not to compete is justified, and if so, how much. And this is the question of whether a covenant not to compete is justified. We haven't gotten to the if so, how much. And the reason, the very dangerous proposition presented by the petitioner's argument, is that the petitioner says, acknowledged, well, if you pay money, you have an otherwise enforceable agreement, so you just look at reasonableness. That is incorrect under the statute. Under the statute, there are two halves. Ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement is enforceable to the extent that its restraints are no greater than necessary to protect the legitimate interest of the promisee. But if the second half of that test is failed, Section 15.51 requires reformation and enforcement. So if you get to the second half of the test, which is reasonable and no greater restraint than necessary, you cannot invalidate a covenant not to compete. The only opportunity under the statute to assess whether there's a prima facie situation that justifies some restraint, we'll figure out how much later, but some restraint, the only place you make that assessment is in the first half of the test, ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement, which is exactly consistent with the common law that predates the statute. As Justice Hecht observed in the DeSantis opinion in 1990, as Chief Justice Jefferson acknowledged in his concurrence in Sheshinoff, ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement, the concept of ancillary has always connoted that it gives rise to this interest. And even the restatement does that. Section 187 of the restatement talks about, first, you have to have an ancillary restraint that gives rise to an interest in restraining competition, or interest worthy of protection. If and only if you do that. If not, it's per se unreasonable.
But before
if and
you
only
get,
if you do that, do you get to the
light,
continuum.
Ancillary just means something other than an abstraction. I mean, at least when DeSantis and the law that preceded it in the restatement was under consideration. It was, you just can't walk down the street, catch somebody and say, I want you to agree never to compete with me just in case we ever do.
Well, that's what's interesting. The law actually used the very phrase gives rise to an interest in restraining competition, as I know you're well aware. That was the test, and that's what the restatement does. This section is called not ancillary. And it says you have to have something that gives rise to an interest in restraining competition.
But wouldn't an employment relationship be enough under the restatement?
Under the restatement, yes. And the statute specifically declined to include relationship as a basis for an otherwise enforceable agreement. The nice thing about it is, by requiring an otherwise enforceable agreement, you know what you have. You look at the agreement, and you can tell, what is it about this agreement that justifies the imposition of a covenant not to compete?
But counsel,
covenants are very important in some circumstances.
The statute doesn't use the terminology give rise either.
Correct. The statute uses the term ancillary.
I mean, it's in some of our case law, but it's nowhere in the statute.
That's correct. Now, the legislature is presumed to have used those words in conjunction with the way that they've been used in the law leading to that time. That's one of the principles of statutory interpretation, is that when the legislature uses a term like ancillary, in fact, if you look at DeSantis, other than the narrowing to just an otherwise enforceable agreement, The statute actually fairly well tracks what the common law had provided. And this court used the term ancillary, has used the term ancillary since. It always connotes something more than just being on the same page. Indeed, if the test were just on the same page, Section 1505 wouldn't really have much meaning, which says every contract in restraint of trade is unlawful.
Otherwise enforceable agreement here is the what, in your view?
There's no dispute that the otherwise enforceable agreement is the transfer of stock at the agreed upon price to Mr. Cook, which Mr. Cook paid for.
But the acceptance of the option agreement, basically?
It is the award of options was in 1996 to actually exercise, to become a stockholder. Now, this idea that option, that the exercise of stock somehow creates some interest that's new, is actually not in the record before the court. All of the evidence about the purpose of this plan was about the plan, right? It's a deferred compensation plan that you want the employee to stick around long enough for the options to be in the money,
right,
because
but he,
that's
but
compensation
he, but he can't,
that they
but he can't exercise it unless he signs the agreement.
Right. That is the.
So what do we do with that? I mean, it strikes me this is an inequity here that it's really not addressed. We haven't talked about, we were talking about windfalls in the previous case. Why isn't this a windfall? Why would we want to allow this situation to occur?
It's a tack on, if you ask me. It's these kinds of incentives to employees are given by employers in reward for their current service.
Mr. But that's not what the employer said it was for.
Well,
at least gets to say.
Well, for example, the options are awarded in 1996. You can't even exercise them for a year. So hopefully Mr. Cook continues to stay with the company, does a good job.
And hopefully the company does better so that
right.
they do become valuable.
Right.
And
isn't that great? It's great for everyone. What is it about that circumstance that justifies, that makes the company need a covenant not to compete more than any other company? Every company wants to protect their customer relationships from solicitation. That every company thinks that would be great. It's like talking on the cell phone in your car. Everyone wants to be able to do it, but they don't want anyone else to be able to do it.
Well, right, but Mr. Cook knew that he didn't get the stock unless he agreed to this restriction.
That was a component of the.
Well, what
the
if
award,
an employer
yes.
said any pay raise is contingent on you on this covenant not to compete? You know, any additional cost of living increase or any bonus, and that's the original employment relationship. It just seems to me there's at least some tension between recognizing that as valid and the legislature's decision to put some restrictions on restraints of trade.
The component of the agreement that is a non-solicitation or non-competition agreement is just void. The law has not allowed. If they say here's $10,000, $100,000, As thank you for your loyal service. We really appreciate everything you've done. And the employee sticks around for 10 years or 20 years and then violates the, allegedly, again, we're assuming that there was a violation here, which we don't agree, violates the covenant not to compete. The employer got the benefit of that incentive. They incentivized, in their theory, incentivized the employee to do a good job.
Does it make a difference that you're talking about a key employee whose work product, if you will, would have a significant impact on the future of the company or the goodwill of a company? I mean, it's one thing if you make the non-compete, I guess, applicable to everybody who were to get some sort of financial benefit, but does the fact that he's a key employee, or do you dispute that?
Well, I think that that's who companies tend to request covenants not to compete
right.
from. They don't tend to request them from the people that can't compete.
So this argument.
You want a covenant from the person who can compete against you, because otherwise, gosh, that would be terrible. That's what their brief says at 31. We need a covenant not to compete because otherwise he could compete. So yes, that tends to be the kind of person who gets a covenant not to compete.
Because the argument about conditioning cost of living raises that really, I'm not sure how that would impact the key employees, if you will.
Yeah, I think
a policy reason.
I think as a matter of public policy, the restraint is just void, and that's the way that it's always been viewed. This test, it's important to note, has been in place for at least 16 years and has not engendered confusion with the courts of appeals. People understand this test. They know what it takes to draft an enforceable covenant not to compete. It's not hard. This is an unusual agreement, perhaps, in that it fails to do so. But Light was correct when decided and makes sense. It's consistent with the common law, and it provides bright line tests that are important for employers, both in the hiring and in retaining their employees. And so if there are no further questions, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Martin.
Did I misunderstand you? I thought you said the otherwise enforceable agreement is the non-solicitation agreement.
It is. It's
and the non-compete the, was separate the, from that.
No,
separate
it was provisions, part of it.
Separate provisions in the same agreement.
There were four promises in the non-solicitation agreement. The promise not to use confidential information, the promise not to disclose confidential information, the promise not to solicit Marsh employees to go to a competitor, and the covenant not to compete.
So the stock option, your view is the stock option was not the ancillary agreement or the otherwise enforceable agreement. Okay.
You have to look at the whole plan from the beginning, because the plan contemplated all these documents be signed. The plan said for key employees there could be an option. The option came later in 1996. The plan also contemplated if you want to exercise, you've got to sign the non-solicitation agreement, this agreement. That was what was signed. If you did that, then the plan also contemplated that the stock would be transferred. I want to make sure I address a couple of questions. Justice Gutzman, you ask about whether or not he had to be a key employee. There are a lot of cases, especially pre-Hill, that talk about what kind of employee could be subject to a non-compete. It has to be an employee who has the ability to utilize his relationship to move that client. And there were several cases, I think that Weatherford Oil is one of them. DeSantis versus Wackenhut has a discussion of it, because in DeSantis, they found that the employee hadn't used his relationship to move the customers. Justice Jefferson, you said that there was a, or you indicated that there was a policy reason that we might not want employers to be able to just give raises in exchange for non-competes, and because it might prevent the employee from working. But nothing about the non-solicitation agreement that Mr. Cook signed stops him from working. It is specifically limited to the clients of Marsh that he worked with while he was at Marsh within a certain period of time. And in all of the goodwill cases, it should be limited only to the clients that the employee has built up over the years. While he's being paid on Marsh's dime, he's going out and meeting with the client. He's doing that for Marsh, not to make his own portfolio bigger. So in every one of these goodwill cases, it ought to be limited, and it is so limited in this case.
Are you then suggesting that a person could leave with a non-compete and solicit everybody else's book of business but not his own, and that would be okay?
Under the cases, it would be, because the idea is that he would have the relationship that that his relationship with those customers that he had lunch with once a week, that that would enable him to appropriate Marsh's relationship for the benefit of Lockton. If it was somebody else's book of business, then he wouldn't have that relationship, and under the law, he wouldn't be able to appropriate the relationship.
But if I'm tempted to use a term from a former colleague, that can't be right, can it? Doesn't that incentivize an employee to take everybody else's customer list on his way out the door but his?
It wasn't the list that he took. It was his relationship.
Well, trade secrets and confidential information, the information and the business assets that are protected in this area of the law.
I'm sure that Mr. Cook got confidential information while he was at Marsh, but that's not the issue in this case. And it wasn't the issue in Hill, because in Hill they said that there was confidential information and the court found that there was just no proof of it. We're talking about the relationship. If he's not the employee with the relationship, then that's not a relationship that can be protected as a result of trying to protect a worthy interest that is the goodwill interest of Marsh. So am I answering your question, or do you...
It was about a related question. Go on with your points and okay. Rebuttal.
You had said, Justice Wainwright, that maybe there was a question that you had about the ability or why you couldn't just sue for a fiduciary duty, and I think if the person steals the relationship. And I think that the answer was, in confidential information situations, it's hard to tell whether or not the employee did wrongly capitalize on the confidential information. Well, if you look at the cases, you'll see it's just as difficult for the employer to prove that the employee capitalized on the goodwill. Because in DeSantis versus Wackenhut, that's exactly what happened. The employee goes out and forms his own business and then sends a solicitation letter to the list of clients of Wackenhut. And then whenever the lawsuit comes along, he says, well, those customers didn't leave because they had a relationship with me. They left because they wanted to leave. I understand I'm out of time, Your Honor. I just wanted to say that if the court doesn't overturn this, then we're back at Hill. And Marsh is without a remedy to enforce a non-compete to prevent its goodwill from walking out the door with a person that it gave very valuable stock options to, in which that person took $50,000 worth of stock and now wants to renege on the agreements that they gave Marsh and that Mr. Cook knew he was going to have to agree to.
Thank you, counsel. That cause is submitted, and that concludes the arguments for this morning. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.